This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for coming today. I can say that I was pretty excited to see the sun this morning. I think everybody was, because you've all been able to come and there hasn't been awful traffic on the road or awful accidents as there has been over the last few days. For you who don't know me, my name's Carisse, and I've been away for 12 months because I had a baby. There she is. And she is named after two landmark women in my life. So Rose was my grandmother on my father's side, a lovely, small Italian lady who was still delivering Meals on Wheels to other people in her 80s. And Neon, who is my husband's nana, who was a nurse during World War II. So when we had this beautiful girl, we thought, what is the best way to celebrate the most important women in our lives? And so we named her after them. I've got a few housekeeping things to do before I hand you over to Katrina Vignando, another wonderful Italian woman who is the head of the development team, and she will be introducing Marion. But before we do that, some important information about how we are proceeding with the bookings for Landmark Women and for all of the other events that we run. It shouldn't change anything for you, except now all of our events are going to be bookable through Eventbrite. So the links to those events will be on the website and on the emails that we send out to you so that you can book straight through to the online booking system. If you happen to ring up because you don't use online and you book through bookings, that's all right too. Just continue to do exactly what you've been doing and we will put your booking through to the system. If you have booked well in ahead for Landmark Women, you do not need to rebook. We will update all of those bookings into the system. And if you need to pay through the system, you will not be charged a fee, so there'll be no additional fee on Landmark Women. We will be absorbing that cost, which is one of the things that some people have an issue with. When it's a small amount of money and you are charged a fee in a booking system, that will not happen with this program. So please, if you have any questions about that, please ask me afterwards or during tea and cake in the lounge. I will hand over to Katrina. Thank you.
Thank you, Carisse. It's great to have Carisse back after her exciting sojourn with Rose. And it's a great pleasure to be introducing Marion Lee, our speaker this morning for Landmark Women. It's the first time I've taken on this role, so it's a great pleasure to be here giving you a little bit of background before Marion goes into her amazing story of her work and her passions and her background, which I think is very timely to be listening to today. It is Refugee Week this week, and another aspect of Marion's invitation to be with us today is that her talk also ties in with a program that the museum is running at the moment called Defining Moments in History. And one of the moments that we have featured is the arrival of Vietnamese refugees in Australia in the 1970s. So Marion will speak to that and give us her personal views and her personal background around that time and how that has inspired her to do the amazing work that she has done. Before Marion comes up on the stage, I just want to give you a little bit of background about Marion and some of her outstanding contributions that she's made to her community and more broadly to Australian cultural life. Marion specialises in refugee and migration law. She has consulted widely on cultural issues both within Australia and Southeast Asia and with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She has been awarded many honours over the years, including the Bicentennial ACT Citizen of the Year, Medal of the Order of Australia in 1990, and the AusCare Paul Cullen Award for Outstanding Contribution to Refugees in 1994. In 2003, she received the prestigious Australian Human Rights Award and, goes on, in 2009, in the Australian Honours List, Marion was awarded the Medal of Australia. So she's a multicultural advocate and has been tirelessly working in the area of human rights and looking at the issues of refugees and now topically with the refugee issues that we all see on television around the Afghan people trying to come to Australia. Marion has been turning her attention to the issues that those people face. So it's a great pleasure to introduce Marion to give us both her personal background around what has inspired her to be active in this role and to hear how her advocacy has been making changes. Marion.
Well, thank you very much for that warm welcome, and thank you all of you for coming along today. Before I start, I'd like to acknowledge firstly the traditional owners of this land and their elders past and present, and I mean that acknowledgement in all sincerity. It's an amazing fact that in ancient times an ancient people walked on this very spot and that the descendants of those people still walk amongst us. The landscape has changed greatly since then, but the people are still here. The memories of their ancestors are with us still. We cannot call their names because we do not know them, but still we honour and pay our respects to them and to their descendants living amongst us today. Without our ancestors, none of us would be here today. And that, I guess, is the theme of, or one of the themes of my talk. The importance of our past, individually, collectively, as citizens and residents of this city and of this land, as a nation and internationally as people of the world. I was reminded a few minutes ago that there's some of my artefacts or something here in the collection of the National Museum. And I also recalled that I was one of the founding members of the Friends of the National Museum. And I don't know how many other people were part of that group that started off advocating, and we used to meet down in the sheds around the lake. And some of us were extremely disappointed when the venue was changed to here. And actually, this was a sacred spot to many of us, because my children were all born here, and I really thought that the other site was really going to be much better. But we've come to know and love the National Museum as it is today, anyway, and where it is. But as a sacred site, this is where I rose to greet each of my children, three of them. And it's also the place that we remember where little girl Benda died. Yeah, and I remember on that day of the demolition, my children all wanted to come and watch. And I thought, I don't want to watch the hospital where they were born being demolished. But my youngest son... he said I wasn't allowed to talk about them, but still. This is off the cuff. So he said, look, Mum, we really need to go. I want to go. He was just quite small. And so I said, I was really worried because in New Zealand, where I was born, we have earthquakes. And we understand how you know, the seismological forces stretch. And I said, I don't think it's very safe to be anywhere near that demolition in case something goes wrong. And, you know, our kids always say, Mum, you're so negative. You know, you always see the worst in things, which is not true. I'm always just cautious. So anyway, I said, well, look, I think what we should do is we should go up that mountain and watch it from up there. And that's exactly what we did. And you knew it when we remember that tragedy. And I was just really grateful that I wasn't sitting where the Bender family were sitting. So this is a sacred spot for many reasons. It's a place of life. It's a place of death. And it's also a place where the first inhabitants of this land walked. And Black Mountain, as I understand it, is called Black Mountain because it was where the blacks lived. So, you know, I do acknowledge those people and all that have gone before us here today. It's actually, it's 68 years. I find it hard to believe, but it is 68 years since my birth in the beautiful little village of Richmond in the province of Nelson in New Zealand when I was born. And here I am standing in the capital city of Australia, Canberra, and very proud to be here. I came in 1971, and then I came to Australia in 1971, and then to Canberra in 1974, and I've lived here ever since. I love this city, and I love the people who are here, and we were just again discussing how vibrant Canberra has become, even in the last 5 years since my friend Jacqueline arrived here from Zimbabwe. So thank you very much for this invitation, and I'm really honoured to be included in this series. I've listened to some of the other people who've presented before me, so I know I'm in really auspicious company. I wanted to talk about the themes of my life and how my childhood growing up in New Zealand has come to fruition in my life over the years, and that the themes that were established in my childhood are what continue to drive me to this day. And some people do describe me as a driven person. Last week saw the Prime Minister and others focus our attention on the 800th anniversary of the proclamation of the Magna Carta in 1215, when the English barons rebelled and pressured the King, John, into signing the Magna Carta, a list of 63 clauses drawn up to limit John's power. It was the first time royal authority officially became subject to the law instead of reigning above it. This Magna Carta was arguably the most significant early influence on the extensive historical process that led to the rule of constitutional law today in the English-speaking world, and importantly, the law, the Constitution, our Australian Constitution. At the same time as celebrating the signing of the Magna Carta 800 years ago and referring in his speech to the fact that we have a copy of that very document displayed here in Parliament House, our Prime Minister contemplated and contemplates still the stripping of Australian citizenship from some Australian citizens without recourse to a court and at the whim of one person, the Minister for Immigration, whoever he or she may be, at the time that the action is contemplated. Moreover, the Prime Minister and various other members of his government have, over the past few weeks, launched an unprecedented attack on a statutory officer appointed to stand independently from government, the Human Rights Commissioner, Gillian Triggs, because she carried out her job and fearlessly stood by her report into the conditions in Nauru and the detention centres around Australia. The attacks on her have drawn the censure of the United Nations, and they have censured our government. The bullying of Gillian Triggs was apparent to all who watched the live broadcast of the Senate Estimates Committee. This is also Refugee Week. The UNHCR, in a media release yesterday, reminded us that, and I quote, "Today on Earth, one in every 122 people has been forced to flee their home because of conflict, persecution, or violence. Of the world's refugees, more than half are now children, children whose short lives have been shaped by war, fear, and loss. The staggering statistics detailed in the UNHCR's Global Trends reports shows the numbers of people fleeing their country, their home, has accelerated to the highest levels we have ever recorded. In the past 5 years, no fewer than 15 conflicts, some new, some old, have brought unspeakable tragedy and misery to millions across the world. The UNHCR has responded. From Syria to the Central African Republic, Iraq to South Sudan, the UNHCR is present in all the world's conflict hotspots, working around the clock to extend protection and life-saving aid to millions of people. But they cannot do that without the help of the signatory countries, and Australia is one of those signatory countries. Unfortunately, at the moment, we are falling far short of what we should be doing in our commitment to the peoples of the world. The conflicts may change, grow, and return, but the consequences for the children and families caught in their chaos remains the same. This week, for those of you that watched it, on the ABC's Q&A on Monday night, and I think repeated again yesterday, a young man called Mohammed Ali Bakiri stood to ask a question. He asked, why is the child? He was detained on Nauru for 3 years of his life without his parents. Now studying law, this young Australian citizen has been active at rallies around Australia for the past 2 years, speaking out against detention, and especially the detention of children. I saw him speak myself last year in Adelaide, and I watched this young man stand on the steps of Parliament House there, speaking to the crowd, and I thought, I wonder if he remembers me. Because I was the person that signed the documents for him on Nauru to make the application with his older brother and his family of children to come to Australia. Something John Howard said will never happen. We will not have people like these coming to Australia. We will decide who comes here and the method by which they come. So Mohammed Ali Bakiri is here today. I watched him on my television screen and I went into my Dropbox on my telephone. Amazing what you can do today with technology, limited though I am with it all, so I don't even have a PowerPoint. But I went and looked on my phone and there he was as a little boy in the photograph that I pinned onto his application form to come to Australia. And I remembered that another young man with the same family name, but as far as I know they're not related, Mahmoud Bakiri, who is one of the people that is reported in a book on refugees written here in Canberra. Mahmoud Bakiri recalled one of my visits to Nauru, and he said that we knew that Marion Leigh was different when she came to Nauru. She was different to everybody else. First, because she wore a headscarf, and secondly, because she spoke to us children. She was the only adult who spoke to us as children. You know, that is the nicest thing anyone has ever said about me, I think, that I spoke to them, and they were children, and they remembered. We often don't speak to the children, and our record on the way we treat children in this society is abysmal. In Canberra too, we have huge numbers of children who are being taken from their families and placed into care, whether it's foster care or kinship care, and I've been the president of the Grandparent and Kinship Care Association here in the ACT. The highest number of children who are in care in Canberra are in fact Aboriginal children. We need to wake up to ourselves about the way that we treat children, whether they're in or out of detention. So to go back to the fact of watching Mohammed Ali Bakiri stand and speak in Parliament House, the Q&A program was actually in Parliament House. I felt so proud of him. Because the potential that we unleash in children when they're small goes with them all their lives. And if we harm a child, then we harm them for all their lives. I'd like to think that I'm here today because I've become a voice for the voiceless, bringing to public attention those who have no voice, who cannot for many reasons speak for themselves, and that I am therefore speaking for them. Inevitably, this commitment has led me into the world of refugees, of abandoned children, of homeless women, and to a lesser extent, the drug addicted and the mentally ill. It requires emotional and mental resilience to work in the shadow worlds of pain, loss, humiliation and degradation that these people have been forced, usually by circumstances beyond their control, to inhabit. Their pain has become my pain. Yet it is the strength and resilience of each of these remarkable, unique human beings which has been my inspiration. I forever ask myself whether I could endure the pain and loss that they have endured and still have the courage to wake to face each day. The inestimable value of a human soul struggling to survive is beyond my capacity to describe, just as, on the other side, it is impossible for me to describe the depths of depravity and degradation to which a human being can sink in order to destroy another. Evil has a human face, and the veneer of civilization lies only thinly on all of us. Being an advocate is never easy. There is sometimes a perception that all that is needed is to be a good talker with an emotional response to a person's expressed need. So, what has brought me to this place, to this day? In the story of my childhood, you will find the beginnings of my continuing passions of today. The passions which include a love of children, which led me to become firstly a teacher. The passions which include an understanding and love for those people who choose to leave their homes for whatever reason to migrate to a new world. The passions which have led me to stand against violence in the homes. The passions which have led me always to try to speak out when I see something is badly wrong in our society. On the day I was born in Hillcrest Hospital, Richmond, Nelson, New Zealand, to Noble and Grace Roderick, I was the first of four children. We were raised in a small two-bedroom house where we always had good food and plenty of activities. Music, drama and sport played a large part in our lives, though we were materially quite poor. My father's grandfather, and I've got a photograph here, is the old man in the photograph here, and alongside him is his wife, Catherine Wheeler, as she was born. She was the daughter of migrants from England who had migrated very early to New Zealand. And in the same photograph, there is their daughter, my great aunt Dolly, with the little baby, who is the only one in that photograph still alive today. Her daughter is actually a woman called Joan Beagle. And if you Google her, you'll find that she's working for the UN. She's working with, she's the head of the Women's Outreach into Africa program. And she works with as head of the AIDS development organisations throughout the international community. So she's the direct descendant, as I am, same level as I call it, of my great-grandfather, who I'll tell you more about in a minute. And the other person in that photograph is my father's youngest brother, my Uncle Laurie, who is a recognised, war hero, who's commemorated in the village in Italy where he died as a member of the Italian partisan movement during World War II. He's well known for the work that he did. He was fluent in several languages, and he died at about the age of 33 in 1946, 1 year before I was born. So only Joan, the baby, is still alive, and she's sprightly 90-something-year-old living in Auckland with an amazing memory and can still remember all of these people. So I brought that photo just to have a little bit of something for you to look at, and, of course, the other photo we'll talk about later. But anyway, my father's grandfather lived to almost 100 years of age, as you can see from the photograph, and he was one of the earliest Portuguese settlers in New Zealand. As it happened, he came to New Zealand by boat. And legend has it that he and the other Portuguese with him almost beat the French to raising the flag in the tiny harbour of Akaroa near Christchurch in New Zealand. And my great-grandfather's relative apparently established the first hotel in Akaroa, but my great-grandfather, Emmanuel Rodriguez, moved to the North Island where he raised his large brood of children, including my grandfather, George Emmanuel Roderick. He became well known in the district for his football playing skills. Short in stature but fast on his feet, he played with the Maori teams and was nicknamed the Weka by the Maoris because of his ability to move in and out between the larger players and run off with the ball to the touchline, dodging around like a little Weka bird. My dad didn't say too much about his grandfather, and I wonder if the old man ever spoke English. To my dad, he was only an old man who waved his stick at the grandchildren as they played around him, and he remembered in old age that all the old man did was cry. I think he probably ended up with Alzheimer's because we have discovered, researching the family tree, that many of our family has succumbed to Alzheimer's. So we think, you know, my cousins and I think that probably our old great-grandfather was had Alzheimer's in old age. But certainly my father didn't have any memory of him except being a very old man, waving his stick and crying all the time. My father never wanted to grow old. He said it was a terrible thing. So he conveniently, I guess, deliberately not committed suicide but just didn't ask for any help when he had a stroke at the age of 80 and died. Anyway, Weka, who was their son, married my grandmother, Elsie Williams. Now, she was a tall, proud woman who I remember very well. She was of Irish, Welsh, Scottish heritage, and she's so different to my short, irresponsible grandfather that it's a constant source of amazement to me that they met. And certainly that it's amazing that they got married. The marriage produced 6 children, 5 boys and a girl, Enid, but 2 years after the birth of the little girl, my grandmother left the home and the children. My grandfather was a shearer, but also a gambler. He would gamble his money before he reached home on payday until the oldest boy, sent by the mother, could persuade him to hand it over before he made it to the local pub. So unable to cope with the stress anymore, my grandmother went to Wellington to find her own way, to find a job and set up a home for the children. When she returned some weeks later, all the children had been taken into care. Only the oldest boy, who was about 14, remained and knew all his life that she went back for the children. The rest grew up hating her, never reunited and never understanding. When I was 16, I went looking for all the family members and the children of my grandmother's second marriage. There was little or no understanding of her pain because the pain of those children was all too great. My dad died at the age of 80 in 1990. Shortly before he died, he called me from New Zealand on the telephone and began to weep, heart-wrenching sobs. He was crying over the pain experienced 70 years before. "I can still see her," he cried. "I can still see little Enid running after the car as Mum drove off. Why did she leave us? How could she do that to Enid?" And I said, "Dad, that was so long ago. That was so long ago. Can't you forget it?" And he said, "No, I see it like it was yesterday." Long before that day, I understood the pain my father felt all his life. But out of his pain came compassion. He taught us to welcome the stranger, the homeless, to our home, to always have a meal and food for all who came, never to turn anyone away, and as a family, to stick together. He never wanted to see any of us divorce, and children were sacred to him. The child is indeed, as word was said, the father of the man. My father went to serve his country, New Zealand, in the Middle East and in Italy in the Second World War. He was a truck driver. His job was to drive the young, vital men to the front and then go back afterwards and pick up those who remained alive or the bodies and parts of those who were dead. He never forgot this. He returned, as so many did from the war and still do, with nightmares and trauma, which unfortunately, despite all his efforts, he could never shake. He married my mother, who'd migrated at the age of 5 from London with her parents and 3 older siblings. They also travelled by boat and settled in Christchurch. My mother's family was stable and full of love, so she provided a stability of purpose and educational goals which my father so desperately yearned for himself and his children. But my mother always called England home. My parents had their ups and downs, but the marriage survived 44 years till my dad died. When my mother's father died, our little grandmother came to live with us from the age of 77 until she died at 96, still living in our home. My parents loved her, and we learned respect for the elderly, and I learned so much from her stories of England and her memories of her grandmother, Granny Sparrow, who lived outside London in a little village where the children visited on occasion. The generations of a family became so important in our lives, and pain and loss walked hand in hand with mischief and laughter. We were wanderers without meaning to be. All my 3 brothers came, like me, to Australia. All of them, like me, eventually settled for a time at least in Canberra. 2 of them worked here on Parliament House, on the Cameron offices, Tuggeranong Hyperdome, and other significant buildings. My youngest brother, Alan, was constantly on the news as an outspoken member of the BLF. Another was a union rep with CFMEU. I remember once down here outside the old Parliament House before the new one was opened, and they were up there building, and my youngest brother was the biggest of us all. He was huge. When he died, he weighed about 27 stone, they said. He was huge. And he used to play rugby here in Queanbeyan and in Canberra with the Maoris, pretending, like my grandfather had done, that he was a Maori. They were so dark, you know. And anyway, on this particular occasion, I was being interviewed about something solidly, you know, serious. And I came on the news that night talking about these things. And, of course, my name wasn't Roderick, so no one knew that we were related. And there was my brother on the news, huge, with all these builders, labourers, people on some sort of strike about Parliament House. Because they all got run off the web. I don't know whether any of you remember, but there was all that union stuff going on, and the BLF were actually, deregistered. And anyway, my brother, apparently they were out at Tuggeranong building the Tuggeranong Hyperdome or something, and some government inspector came, and he presented his credentials that they have to do before they go onto a union site, and he said he wanted to speak to my brother. And my brother said to the guy, "I'm too busy building to talk to this guy." He said, "Tell him to go and wait in the union office," which was a demountable, you know, really hot. It was a very hot Canberra day. And apparently he was always mischievous, my brother. My mother, in fact, said that he was the most humorous of all of us as kids, the naughtiest and the most humorous. But anyway, he was always playing tricks on people. So he said to this guy, "Go and show him to the demountable, tell him to sit down, give him a coffee, and then tell him I'll be with him." But he said, "As you come out, lock him in." And then he says that he completely forgot him. And the guy was in there for 2 or 3 hours in the heat and the whatever, locked into this demountable. And when he came out, he said, "Oh, I don't have anything to say. I need to go home and have a rest." And my brother was on the television screen that same night with me, trying to explain away how they'd locked this poor guy in this demountable. Anyway, so we were quite... we were both given, I suppose, or all of us have been given over the years to speaking up for the various causes we believed in. But I often thought that sometimes I could see 2 of my brothers were actually at loggerheads in the different unions, and you could almost understand how the Irish would come to blows within their own families in disputes when I could see it happening politically within my own family. And one of my brothers at least doesn't have any track with what I do with migrants and refugees. So growing up in the same family doesn't necessarily mean that you all share the same beliefs and the same focus or passions. So I have to say that. Not everyone would agree with what I picked up from my parents. But anyway, my brothers, Alan and Noble, left here after Parliament House was completed, and both became successful builders in Cairns, where Alan died in 1997, the morning after Princess Diana. And he's the one that had this good sense of humour, so he watched the news of her death on TV and he commented weakly that, well, she'll be there to meet me when I arrive at the gates of heaven. Many of the significant buildings in Cairns, including the casino, were built by him and his team. To this very day, once a year, the locals hold their annual rugby match in honour of Big Al. Rugby, the strong Labour Party values of the New Zealanders Michael Joseph Savage and John A. Lee, through his wonderful political writings, which included a book called Simple on a Soapbox, the British Keir Hardie and his cloth cap, all shaped my views politically and led to many political discussions in our home, especially because we were often in conflict at election time. So why have I chosen to talk about this here today? Because you can read about my achievements in the media and on the internet, but what you cannot read so easily is about the people who shaped me and my values, my parents and the history of the families from which they came, the Catholic Church into which I was born by virtue of my father, the Protestantism which I later embraced for myself, the books I read, the music I love, the political independence of my views, and my strong advocacy for the vulnerable in our society. My political development is due to the years of formal education in both Australia and New Zealand, my university study in both countries, at Christchurch Teachers College and Canterbury University, and then the Alliance College of Theology and the ANU here in Canberra, where I completed my honours degree in history and my graduate studies in international law. At the ANU particularly, I was fortunate to experience the amazing teachers who have been my inspiration and my mentors and have remained, or did remain, until the death of some of them, to become my friends and advisors, teachers who included Manning Clark, John Maloney and his wonderful wife Denise, my dear friend Father John Eddy, the senior Jesuit here for many years, Professor Don Gregg and his wife Rosalie Borkland, and many others. I taught in Canberra for over 20 years, mostly at St Francis Xavier High School, or college as it is now, and I'm proud of the students who are making their own unique contribution to this city and this country. I owned and operated two Vietnamese restaurants here in Canberra with my husband as head chef for over 15 years. I've assisted people from almost every country in the world to settle here. I pay great tribute to the former Chief Minister John Stanhope for his immediate reaction when I asked him if I could bring 10 Afghan families straight off Nauru and into the Canberra community. His response was unhesitating. Jack Waterford and the Canberra Times played an important role in assisting in the initial settlement here of those families directly off Nauru in 2004. Over the years, I've assisted migrants and refugees from many countries settle into Canberra, and I'm proud of the people of this great city for the way in which we welcome and accommodate the stranger in our midst. I applaud Nick Manicus and his department for their vision and commitment to multiculturalism in our city. I love this city, and I hope that in years to come I can continue to contribute. There are so many more things to achieve here. At the moment, we have a need to reform our care and protection systems so that this territory can become a beacon for all states and territories in the way we care for our children and the families who need us. We have a serious problem with some of our young people. If you read the court lists, the court reports, you can see that every day in the Canberra Times. And the juvenile justice system, the prevention systems, clearly are in need of reform. And public housing is still at crisis level. It's been that way for many years. And it should be a focus point for the coming election. We need to house our citizens appropriately in affordable housing. It breaks my heart to see people sleeping outside the Legislative Assembly and nearby, near the other museum in the city, sleeping homeless in freezing cold winter conditions in Canberra. And with an ageing population, we baby boomers and those earlier should still have enough life in us to shape our lives for the next 20 years or so, so that we can have fun and live full lives as well as well into our 80s. And now I turn not only to Canberra but to some of the things that have affected me over the years and which I want to share quickly with you today. I want to know what's the time. Sorry. 7.5 minutes. Okay, thank you. I've just said I need to be, someone needs to keep an eye on what I'm doing. I talked just briefly about some of the legislation that this government is trying to put through in Parliament House or in Parliament. And one of the pieces of legislation, which I actually think might have gone through while I was blinking my eyes in Adelaide earlier this week, and that is the amendments to the Migration Act called the Good Order Bill in detention. I'm not sure if it went through or not, but it was certainly to be debated. And this is what the Honourable Stephen Charles QC, who's a retired Victorian court judge, said in his opening statement at the Senate hearing into that bill. I'm a retired judge of the Victorian Court of Appeal. I want to address some legal points, trying to view it from the viewpoint of the way a court might approach this. One has to bear in mind at the outset that these amendments to the Migration Act will, in effect, result in guards being authorised to beat asylum seekers in detention to death on the basis that they reasonably believe it is necessary for some reason to do so. Now, that is a bill that is before our Parliament or, as I say, I'm unfortunately not sure, it possibly went through this in the last few days. Now, I wanted to talk to you about the issue of children in detention. And as you can see, I've got a photograph here of a group of children lying together on a floor. Now, this photograph is actually of children awaiting removal from the Darwin Detention Centre to Nauru. And Gillian Trigg's report on Nauru, which if you haven't read it, at least read some of it by going online and getting a copy or ring the Human Rights Commission and have a look. The situation on Nauru is appalling. Women are being raped there. Children are becoming sick. Some of them in the past have been brought to Australia, but the government has decided in its wisdom that there is too much of an outcry when that happens, and some of the do-gooders among the human rights activists actually might get access to them. And so they are currently trying to arrange with India to have people who are sick, children who are sick, be sent to India for treatment. And in fact, last week I was reading about a child with a broken arm, and the mother was begging that that child's arm be treated, and the department's response was, well, we are still waiting a clearance from India for him to go there for treatment. Now, these things are being done in our names. Unbelievable. But they are being done in our names. Now, there were three other children in this category of babies awaiting transportation, if I can use that word, to Nauru with their parents. These were the children who were born after the 5th of December deal that some of you might remember with the crossbenchers in Parliament, where they were told that if you will agree to this bill going through the Parliament, we will release the children who are currently in detention. What they didn't include, or the government, Scott Morrison, as the minister at the time, did not include, was the fact that there were many pregnant women who were at that time waiting to give birth, and that children born after the passage of the bill would still be transported to Nauru, and that so these babies have been born after the 5th of December last year, and they have been or are in the process of being deported to Nauru. And I want to read you a chilling eyewitness account of what happened in April, so just 6 weeks ago. And this was by someone who was viewing or interviewing these families, some of the families who were moved from Darwin to Melbourne Detention Centre. And she wrote, "This week I met with families who'd been transferred down from Darwin last Sunday. They were previously on Nauru and then brought to Darwin to have their babies. These babes were born after the 1st of December deal with the crossbench senators. The families were transferred to Melbourne to stop the protest which was building in Darwin in reaction to the threatened transfer of baby Edwin and his parents back to Nauru. This was the catalyst to the trouble as the families tried to get through to Red Compound to rescue three-month-old baby Edwin and his mother." I think Edwin is one of these children in this photo. "The father had been taken somewhere else. The families individually told me about their extraction from Wickham Point Detention Centre at 5 a.m. on a Saturday morning. Large numbers of police and guards entered their rooms and physically pulled them from their beds, handcuffed them and removed them. Three of the couples had babies aged 3 months and 4 weeks old. The police and guards took one baby away from his mother because she was crying as her husband was taken. This mother says they did not bring her baby back until 10 a.m. The father is in shock. The husbands and sons were separated from mothers and daughters. Men were taken in police vans to a police lockup in Darwin somewhere. This included a 17-year-old boy. When they realised his age, he was taken out of the cell with his father and put in a room in solitary. The 17-year-old boy says 15 commandos, his words, woke him at 5 a.m. and pulled him from his bed. He was pushed to the floor and handcuffed behind his back. He was crying, 'What have I done?' But no one answered. He said that his little brother, aged 9 years, had his arms grabbed and pushed up his back and that he was so afraid he wet himself. The women and children were taken to Bladen interview rooms and put in individual rooms in which there was a mattress and pillow on the floor and nothing else. The door was kept open with a guard sitting on the floor at the door. No one was allowed to leave the rooms until afternoon. One woman, who has a 4 weeks-old baby, was separated from her husband and taken with the men to the police lockup. She was told that he was a ringleader. She's lost her milk and now the baby is having formula. The father was put in one of the Bladen rooms. He says that the cold air conditioning was put on high and the remote was taken away. When he complained that it was too cold for his four-week-old baby, they said too bad. He also said that he was given no milk or nappy for the baby until 8:30 a.m. The baby was screaming with hunger as she was fed last at 2 a.m. They were all locked up until around 3 p.m. on Sunday, when they were taken with guards at either side and frog-marched onto buses and to a plane to Melbourne. These families, she says, are in absolute shock. The husbands barely spoke. The wives cried as they told me their story." And then she goes on to say what she's witnessed herself. "In the past few weeks, we've seen an escalation in the use of force and mechanical restraints. A young woman weighing 48 kilos was grabbed and handcuffed without notice by four guards and dragged to the solitary area at the back of the detention centre in Melbourne, where she was locked in a room. She was heard crying out for 2 hours, begging to be allowed to go to the toilet. She was then put in a van with guards on either side and taken on a plane for Nauru. She was a little thing. Why the exhibition of excessive force? It has terrified all who witnessed it." Now, that's from a person I know very well who interviewed those people in the Melbourne Detention Centre. And she goes on to another incident that, again, she was there and witnessed. "A young woman was held in a van for hours, asking to go to the toilet. We know her as extremely dignified and refined. She eventually had to squat inside the van to relieve herself. Can you imagine the indignity? This girl and her sister and brother were subsequently put on 3 different flights with 7 guards each. That was absolutely unnecessary. Now, this week I was actually in a detention centre in Adelaide. And I was there because there's a young man who's now 21 years old. He came here as an 18-year-old to seek asylum from a situation in his home country. His grandfather has lived in this country for over 20 years. His grandfather is an Australian citizen, as is his grandmother. His grandfather, 82 years old, with his walking stick, came to the detention centre with this young man's brother, his aunt-in-law, and who was there? Oh, and his wife. Now, all of these people are Australian citizens. They came to beg the immigration authorities, 2 representatives, beg them to release that boy into their care because he's mentally ill. Psychologically, mentally, emotionally incapable of being returned to his home country. We have doctor's certificates, medical certificates that say that being in detention has brought about his complete breakdown and that he's not fit enough to travel. The department has made it very clear that the will of the minister is that if you have become a so-called failed asylum seeker, you will be removed. And they told them in no uncertain terms about how they had removed an old lady or old people on stretchers, despite the fact that they had Australian citizen relatives. And they said, we can take him no matter how sick he is. If we have to, we will medicate you. That boy just rambled and rambled, and I watched as the old man, who was himself a refugee from a communist country, begged. And he said, please, where is justice in this country? Where is freedom? Why is my grandson treated like this? And if you send him back, he will be killed. Or his fear, and I believe this, his fear will drive him to kill himself before those people who are targeting him do it for him. I watched these people. I watched his aunt, who's married to his uncle, beg them. Just look at him. He's sick. How can you do this? He's our family member. He's sick. And if he goes back, he will die. And the immigration officers said, and I feel sorry for them because they're only voicing the words of their masters. They said that we actually believe you. But it was not our decision that saw him refused his visa. And it's not our decision that he now has to leave. And the only person who can probably do anything for you is Marion. Yesterday I spoke on the telephone and I lost it to another immigration officer. Used to lose it a lot when I was young. Now I don't do it very often, but I did it yesterday. I called the Minister for Immigration, the past one, Scott Morrison, an unthinkable name, which I won't say here, but I did say I might talk about it tomorrow. Because the last action that Miss, and I will talk about it, and if they keep this girl in detention, I will tell you. I will make it very clear across the media that it's done because of what I'm saying today. Do you know the last action that Scott Morrison did? At 2:43, before he finished being Minister for Immigration at 3 o'clock, he signed a visa cancellation of a young girl who used to live here in Canberra. He cancelled her permanent resident visa because of something her father is alleged to have done. Her father is alleged to have been a people smuggler. He hasn't been caught. But that girl is married and she has 2 beautiful children. They lived here in Canberra. I went to Vietnam for the holidays on the 23rd of December. On that same day, Scott Morrison And someone in the department told me he knew I'd gone. He signed and he wrote the time so people would know he did it before he ceased being minister. He signed a cancellation of her permanent resident visa, which meant when she went into the Department of Immigration in Sydney, they dragged her from her two little girls, beautiful little girls who've played in my house. Both of them under, one of them I think is now 5 and a half because she's going to school. They dragged the mother away and the children screamed and screamed and the father apparently went amok. They took the girl and they put her in detention. She's still in detention 6 months later. The children started to self-harm. They agreed that those children who are Australian citizen kids would be allowed to live with her in detention. The Human Rights Commission did a report on her and sent it to the Immigration Department to ask them, what is happening about these children? And they said, oh, they're not in detention. They're only there because the mother asked for them to be with her. They're not in detention. They're just there because their mother asked for them to be there. Now, at the moment, the minister, this current minister, has agreed that she can probably be released. But guess who's doing all the work for that? Me. And the other day they said, oh, you still haven't done X piece of paperwork, which is very difficult because the girl's in detention doesn't have access to any of her documents. I said, look, yesterday, are you, you know, really, I'm over this. That man put this girl in detention for nothing. She's a recognised refugee. The UN, if they knew about it, would be horrified. Now I'm horrified. I'm over it. 6 months. Those children started self-harming. They're allowed to go to school. They go to the school just down from the Villawood Detention Centre and the principal there apparently has asked several times what can she do for them. And the mother who's allowed to take them there, I think under escort, she's done nothing wrong. She's not a criminal. She's a young, beautiful woman. And the principal said, what can we do? Because these children are self-harming. So what is happening? She's supposed to be paying herself for them to get a psychological report every so often to see what can be done. What can be done is let them out of detention and don't lie about it when you're talking to the Human Rights Commission. Because what would happen if these little kids, 3 and 5, I think they are, 3 and 5 years, walked to the guards and said, we're not really in detention. We're Australian citizens. We just want to go for a walk. It's ridiculous. It's cruel. And it's happening every day in our name. Every day in this country. Let's look at what's going on about paying the people smugglers. How dare they? How dare they? When I was in Adelaide, there was a cartoon. I'm sorry, I'm not good at technology. But there's a cartoon there and it's called Turning Back the Boats. And, of course, there's the people smugglers with all the people on the sinking, almost sinking boat and an Australian naval vessel in the background and Tony Abbott and his budgie smugglers with his loud hailer and the happy people smuggler is saying, well, of course I'm profiting from an evil trade. I've got your check here to prove it. What is going on in our government? What is going on in a country where so many of our women are being bashed in their own homes, where so many children taken into care are being returned to their fathers who have bashed their mothers in the name of the rights of the father to have access to his children? Listen to the voice of my father. All those years later, and yet I know cases here in Canberra where men who have abused and beaten the mothers of children, of their children, are told, well, you are allowed to have access and the children can sleep overnight and the abuse continues. We have a very, very sad record in this country of the way we treat children. Thank you. There are any questions? Yes.
It is quite late, and that was a pretty emotional and amazing presentation. But would anybody like to ask Marion a question? Is that better?
Yes.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ken. Would anybody like to ask Marion a question?
Marionette Shoba, thank you for your love and care that you show the people who are less vulnerable and more vulnerable. Sorry, I'm emotionally upset too. Thank you for sharing so much of your life and what motivates you to help these people. You came from a Catholic background, and Tony Abbott comes from a Catholic background. How come you're so different? So different.
Well, thank you, Sherba. Actually, Tony Abbott and I used to know each other. We're still doing, I guess. But Tony would, you know, before he was in Parliament, he would save a seat for me whenever there was a function on. Under the Labor government, Bob Hawke, there used to be lots of functions. It was a really good time to be in Canberra. And you'd get invited to various dinners and functions, and a lot of talk fests went on. And Tony would, you know, usually save a seat for me. I'd turn up a little bit late and Tony would be... And the thing he wanted to talk about all the time was multiculturalism and religion. And I once said, you know, Tony, it's really quite boring when you keep just... Because all he wanted to do actually was argue. And now I wish that I had sat there and argued more. Because how was I to know that this man would one day be Prime Minister of Australia? I think the question about the religion is a very intense and very deep one. And I do understand where Tony's coming from. I also understand where Scott Morrison's coming from. Very fundamental right-wing Christian background. Tony's very sincere in his Christianity, and I suppose it's just the different emphasis that we put on the things that are important, and whether you see the separation of church and state. And as I say, it's a very long and involved discussion, which we could take a whole hour or more to talk about, and it would be one that I'd like to have one day with Tony. I will say this, that I don't think that anyone who calls themselves a Catholic or a Christian can really countenance the sorts of things that are being done now in our names. And when we've had the UN, you know, condemn us, when we have the world that used to look to us for leadership in these things, now standing back and going, what's going on in your country? You know, the countries around Syria that are taking thousands of people a day, or were at one stage taking 10,000 people a day across their borders. And we create the kind of furor that we do over a few hundred. And then we have this problem of the Rohingya in their thousands in boats. And I'm being interviewed on Asia TV and radio out of Singapore. And they ask, what is happening in your country? When we refused to assist the people of Southeast Asia to handle this problem. You know, I mean, I don't think that I could do any justice to, you know, where the religious convictions of Tony or anyone else come into it. I do think that Tony is a sincere person, but he's sincerely wrong.
One last question. Can you also fill us in on what we can do to stop the abuse of children and the releasing of children out of detention? Thanks, Marion.
Well, you know, you see the double speak, the smoke and mirrors. That was the problem on the 5th of December when people were desperately trying to get through to the crossbenches to say to them, you're being sold a lie here in reality. And we still have children in detention. The other day I heard someone... I don't know whether it was the minister Mr. Dutton saying that, you know, we only have so many children in detention now, but under the Labor government we had all these. And it's one of the things they throw at Gillian Triggs, is that she didn't publish her report until after, you know, this government got into power. But I think the point Gillian's making, and the point I make, is one child in detention is too many. You know, so how can we stop abuse of children? We have to start with educating our own children. We have to educate boys and girls that abuse of anyone is not on, it's not right. And whether it's a boy abusing a girl or a girl abusing a boy. And believe me, a lot of women abuse men as well. They do it in a different way, but they still abuse them. So I don't know, I don't have a simple answer to that, but I think we have to come out loud and clear and say, call something what it is when we see it. And once we started locking children in detention, I called it. I think I was the first person to call it in the days of Philip Ruddock. Child abuse. That's what it is. It's child abuse. And we will reap the whirlwind from that. We will. When we see Mohammed Ali Bakiri, who actually was living in Nauru, and that the situation in Nauru in those days was not so bad. Baxter, Port Hedland, the other detention centres, were far worse. They were hell. On Nauru, at least at that time, the children could go to school. They could go swimming and fishing. Nowadays, that doesn't happen at all. And they're living in squalor, in tents, with hardly enough running water. You read those reports, that report from Gillian Trigg. If you're not proud of what you're doing, let me put it the other way. If you are proud of what you're doing, you're not going to hide from it. You're not going to abuse the person who presents a report, are you? You're either going to say, whoops, didn't know it was that bad, we'll act to fix it. Or you say, well, I'm proud of what we're doing, abusing children in this way, of making sure that women don't get sanitary pads just because we've got the power to be able to stop them having them on Nauru. You know, you take ownership, but that's not happening. They're hiding. They're telling half-truths or they're telling blatant lies.
I'd just like to follow on your comment about how detrimental to the people it is when they have to enforce these laws. Mm. I have a friend, a retired naval officer, and they said that there's more post-traumatic stress amongst the people that are turning back the boats than there are in the defence force that came back from Afghanistan.
I almost think I should do a Tony Jones on that and say I'll take that as a comment, because that's true. You imagine, and I've heard someone say this, they saw the bodies floating in the water for miles from a boat that they were told not to rescue. And the people, you know, the bodies are there. And when they were pulling babies out of the water, imagine that. Mm. So, yeah, the people that are serving us in that way are being forced to do unconscionable things in our name. And the same with the Immigration Department officials. I don't know whether you read the Canberra Times recently to see how many people have left that department. And people I know who are still working there put their heads down now and are hoping, you know, that they'll last it through to their superannuation payouts. Some of them absolutely hate it. But the other thing I've noticed, and they might strike me off as a migration agent for saying this, is the dumbing down of the department. And nobody cares. You know, I put in an application or something and it doesn't get handled for 4 months, 5 months. I've got we've got applications in that normally under the law had to be finalised within 3 months, 90 days, and people are waiting 3 years. And then a case this week, someone's waiting 1.5 years and with dependent children, and suddenly those children are no longer dependent. They've got the jobs and the parent or parents cannot find work because they're in limbo. So they're being supported by the children who are working at Macca's, KFC, and getting a small amount of money to help them survive. And suddenly a departmental officer says, oh, now I have to assess whether in fact your children are dependent on you and whether they can be assessed as part of your application after all. You know, it's cruel, it's horrible, it's unconscionable, and it's totally unnecessary. But the effect on people who are employed in that work is unimaginable. And yes, I've heard from doctors the same thing, that they're treating people within the department, within the defence forces, within the Navy particularly, for post-traumatic stress disorder. And in fact, I know a doctor here who gave up his position and has left altogether because he himself started suffering from the effects of listening to people.
Hello, Marion. I'm deeply touched by your story, and I think everybody here would be too. It's gut-wrenching. I came out here as a migrant child in 1952, and my husband too came a year earlier with his family. We met in Bendigo. We were married here in Canberra 54 years ago, I think, something like that. But I often wonder when I hear these dreadful stories whether the old migrant system was very basic accommodation, but where families are held together and where there is an office you can go to if you have a problem with translating a document, or you have a freedom but you're still protected in a sense. So you have basic, very basic facilities which a lot of people here would not tolerate, but at least you had a freedom. You could go outside the gate, you could go looking for work, and you were subsidised and you had free accommodation. But then once you obtained a job, you had to pay board, you had to pay for your living expenses. But again, I often think, why can't they put up more migrant hostels, which are individual cocoons? The families stay together, they're still supervised because you've got to report back to get your meal card or whatever it is in your linen, clean linen every week. So you're being taken care of. But at the same time, a lot of these people who are coming out on boats and risking their lives on boats don't speak the language. They need a lot of care and not restriction and constraint and abuse. But I feel that is a great possibility. We all survived it. We've done very well. You know, we worked hard, but we've done it.
Well, thank you for that. My husband came on a boat in 1977 from Vietnam, and they went into the hostels in Villawood, actually, which is now the detention centre. And so they were accommodated in those hostels, and some of you who are here in Canberra remember the times when we resettled people in Canberra directly from the camps to save them going through the hostel situation. We said, and we pioneered that here in Canberra, where we said, let's bring them in and have these people supported in the community, much as you're saying, but we put them straight into government-provided housing, and where we couldn't, then the settlement groups who were helping them arranged to help them pay their rent for the homes. And the children just went straight to school. I was talking to someone else about the Introductory English Centre that, you know, I was one of the original friends of the Introductory English Centre here in Canberra, which was set up then to cope with the English language needs of the children. But we're looking at a different policy now, and we're looking at people who are driven by fear and ignorance as to why these people have come. And over 90% of all people who've arrived here by boat have been found to be refugees, and yet we are punishing them. And when I look at the children in this display photo here, it really reminds me of another photograph that was in Time magazine, where they lined up the bodies of the children who had been gassed and then shot in the head in Syria. And the number of children who were slaughtered, deliberately slaughtered in Syria, is phenomenal. That grown men, in most cases men, actually take a gun and shoot a child in the head deliberately. And they were just lined up exactly like these children are lined up in the detention centre here waiting transportation to Nauru. For what reason? Because their parents brought them from situations like Syria so that it didn't happen to them there. But for some reason we're punishing the victims, not the perpetrators. So, you know, I agree with you that, of course, all people need freedom. One of the things that happened with the detentions, with the Villawood IDC, as it is now, the detention centre, when that was transformed into a detention centre, they actually had Cambodians living there in the way you said. And suddenly one night they turned up with a huge bus and started loading them all onto it to transfer them to aeroplanes to be sent to the opening, they were the first intake into Port Hedland. And at that point, the regime changed. That was under the Labor government. And Gerry Hand and others at that time took that decision that the places of refuge and of protection would become detention centres. And there were immigration officers at that time throwing themselves in front of the bus to stop the buses moving with those families. But it went ahead. And we've had the detention regime ever since.
I'll just interrupt, sorry, Marion. I know that there's probably more questions we're not going to be able to get to, so we've got one more question at the end here, and I know a lot of you will have parking meters that are ticking down at the moment. So we'll have one more question, and then please, if you have any more questions for Marion, I hope she can stay with us in the lounge for a little bit and you can talk to her yourself. Thank you.
Thanks for your account of what's been going on. I think I agree with you. I was here when they had when we were so welcoming to the people who came from Vietnam. I don't recall much opposition at the time to that, and community groups welcomed them and everything. What's changed? You indicated there's a fear element now. I had an opportunity to put this question to Jim Molan at a forum last week here in Canberra, and his answer, he's the architect he's quite proud of it, of Operation Sovereign Borders. And he's Tony's advisor on these matters, a retired major general. And his answer was, well, the difference is these people are using people smugglers, whereas the Vietnamese didn't do that. I don't think that's correct. I don't have the figures on any of that, but seems like it's something deeper that's changed in our society that's led us to being so fearful and so reluctant to accept people.
It's true that most of the Vietnamese came directly from Vietnam in their own boats, those that arrived here, and those that went to Malaysia and to the other camps, they came in boats of people that they knew. They weren't using an intermediary. Of course, some of them were paying people to get on those boats, and there used to be a woman in Melbourne who they paid the money back to. So some of them did pay the boat operators, but those were generally boats that were put out to sea by their owners who were also fleeing and who took passengers along to pay for the voyage. Look, the whole issue of control of our borders is a very, very complex one. And I think that they've used this excuse that we're saving lives at sea, you know, so we will turn back the boats to save lives at sea. And I think that's a false premise to act on, because if you're not dying at sea, you're dying somewhere else. So what we have to do is have a regional solution to this situation, as we did in those days of the Indo-Chinese refugees, set up a system, which is what they were asking for 2 or 3 weeks ago. That was the first time I'd heard a concerted cry from the countries of Southeast Asia, from Indonesia, from Malaysia, from Thailand, and even for that matter from Burma, as I call it, Myanmar, to try to solve the problem of the Rohingyas in their thousands. I can't even contemplate thousands of people in boats waiting to land somewhere and dying. So we have to solve this problem, and the only way we can do it is if we will negotiate with the other countries of the region, with the UN, as the UN are wanting us to do. But to keep saying that the reason we're doing this, the reason we're turning people back, the reason we're scuttling their boats and paying people smugglers, that just doesn't make any sense at all. you know. So the reason we're doing it is to stop the people smugglers. I don't think that's the sensible thing, and I think that they hide behind that. But we do need to be looking at the situation as it has arisen in these last years. But the fear, there is no doubt that the fear has come out of the rise of terrorism. And it really started when John Howard was there when the towers went down in America. And suddenly that kind of violence was brought home to him in a very real way. And that's when we got this idea of we must protect our borders. And I agree, we must protect our borders. But I think we've gone overboard in that area. Sorry, can I just say one last thing? I've got some little photographs here of this one. If any of you want to take a little graphic reminder with you, and for those of you who pray, or those of you who feel that you might want to take up the issue of children in detention and of the cruelty of what's happening to these people, if you want to take one of these away, I'd be very happy. I'll just run off a few of them for anyone that's interested.
Thank you, Marion. We've already, Chris has already mentioned that you can follow on any of the conversations, and I'm sure many of you have many more ideas and questions for Marion and her very deep involvement with this issue. So please join us in the Friends Lounge for refreshments if you can. And Marion, from all of us, thank you so much for that very personal view of your passion in this area. Thank you.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.